Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. Some readers know Elliot Ackerman from his writing in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, or from seeing him on CNN, PBS, Charlie Rose, and others. And so now we have his first novel, Green on Blue, one that's quite different from other fiction by his fellow war veterans. Elliot Ackerman tells his story in the voice of a young Afghan who enlists to serve with Afghan special forces fighting the Taliban in order to be able to cover hospital care and costs for his brother, who was severely wounded in a bombing attack in the local bazaar. So here's what Phil Klei, whose story collection Redeployment won the National Book Award in Fiction, said about this book. In all too many accounts of the Afghan war, the Afghan people caught in the crossfire are rendered invisible. Elliot Ackerman's eye-opening Green on Blue places them front and center, taking us into the life of a Pashtun orphan, navigating the impossible choices offered to him by the brutal realities of his war-torn country, an incisive and moving glimpse into the human consequences of decades of conflict. Elliot Ackerman served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's a decorated veteran, earned a Silver Star and Purple Heart and Bronze Star for Valor. He holds degrees in literature and international affairs from Tufts, served as a White House fellow in the Obama administration. He's now writing about the Syrian civil war from Istanbul. Thanks again to Elliot Bay. Please help me welcome Elliot Ackerman to the Seattle Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Chris, and thank you to the Seattle Public Library for hosting and to Elliot Bay Books for providing copies of the novel. I thought I would just start at the beginning of the book. The novel opens with the voice of Aziz, the protagonist in his story. Many would call me a dishonest man, but I've always kept faith with myself. There is an honesty in that, I think. I am Ali's brother. We are from a village that no longer exists, and our family was not large or prosperous. The war that came after the Russians, but before the Americans, killed our parents. Of them, I have only dim memories. There is my father's Kalashnikov hidden in a woodpile by the door. Him cleaning it, working oiled rags on its parts, and the smell of gunmetal, and feeling safe. There is my mother's secret, the one she shared with me. Once a month, she'd count out my father's earnings from fighting in the mountains or farming. She'd send me and Ali from our village, Sperkai, to the large bazaar in Orgun, a 2-day walk. The Orgun bazaar sold everything, fine cooking oils and spices, candles to light our home, and fabrics to repair our clothes. My mother always entrusted me with a special purchase. Before we left, she would press an extra coin in my hand, one she'd taken from my father. Among the crowded stalls of the bazaar, I would slip away from my brother's watchful eye and buy her a pack of cigarettes, a vice forbidden to a woman. When we returned home, I would place the pack in her hiding spot, the birchwood cradle where she'd rocked Ali and me as infants. Our mud-walled house was small, 2 thatch-roofed rooms with a courtyard between them. The cradle was kept in the room I shared with Ali. My mother would never get rid of the cradle. It was the one thing that was truly hers. At night, after we'd returned from the bazaar, she'd sneak into our room, her small, sandaled feet gliding across the carpets that lined the dirt floor. Her hand would cup a candle, its smothered light casting shadows on her young face, aging her. Her eyes, one brown and the other green, a miracle or defect of birth shifted about the room. Carefully, she would lean over the cradle as she'd done before taking us to nurse. She would run her fingers between the blankets that once swaddled my brother and me. And, finding the pack I'd left her, she'd step into the courtyard, and I'd fall back asleep to the faint smell of her tobacco just past my door. This secret made me feel close to my mother. In the years since, I've wondered why she entrusted me with it. At times, I thought it was because I was her favorite. But this isn't why. The truth is, she recognized in me her own ability to deceive. So that's the opening of the novel. You know, in telling any story, I think the writer is always groping in the dark. You know, the beginning becomes the middle becomes the end becomes the beginning. So when you sit there at the end of the writing process, you ask yourself, where did this whole thing start? It's difficult to know. I served in Afghanistan from 2008 to 2011, and in that time, I exclusively acted as a combat advisor to Afghan troops. So my war buddies, although some were Americans, most of them were Afghans. You know, and we did all the things people do in war. You know, we fought together, we bled together, we mourned friends together. But when the war was over for me and I came home, I knew that I would never see any of them again, trapped as they were in that country's elliptical conflict. So these weren't a bunch of guys that I could friend on Facebook, get quarter beers at the local VFW, or call long distance. And they were Afghan soldiers. And so in writing this book, I really was trying to render their world and their war as they saw it in what really, to me, kind of became like a last act of friendship. So, you know, when I think to kind of the antecedents of this book, you know, and what it was I was trying to do by telling this story, I often go back to one anecdote and something that kind of became a rhythm for me in Afghanistan as an advisor. So with one unit I served with in southeastern Afghanistan in a place called Paktika province, which is right on the border with Pakistan and South Waziristan, the unit was led by a man named Commander Isak. And this was about 300 Afghans. They were Tajik, and they were basically a paramilitary army. And once every 2 weeks, as Isak's primary combat advisor, I would go down to his hooch, which was a plywood hut on a small fire base about two and a half football fields in diameter. And we would have what was very grandly called our operational planning meeting, which really consisted of me coming into Isak's hooch, sort of flopping down on this lumpy sofa that was in one corner. And Isak would kind of go into his, rummage through his things, and he would bring over on the little table in front of us, a plywood table, he would lay out a pack of smokes and a pot of chai. And we would sit there, two of us, and we would be staring across the room at two things. Up on the wall was hanging a large map and a large calendar. So I'd sit there and I'd say, all right, Commander Isak, you know, next couple of weeks, you know, we got to plan out our operations. You know, what do you think we should do? He'd been there for a decade. He knew the ground better than anybody. And Isak would cross the room. He would go look at the map and the calendar, and he was sort of, you know, rubbing the stubble on his chin, would point up to the border, and he'd point, you know, pick a village. He'd say, you know, he'd look at maybe Rara Kare, and he'd say, you know, Mr. Elliot, he's like, there's always very good hunting up in Rara Kare. He's like, why don't we go to Rara Kare? So I'd say, all right, that sounds good, Isak. We would block off 4 or 5 days on the calendar. We would get into our trucks, about 120 Afghans, maybe 10 vehicles. We would drive up to Rara Kare, take us a couple days to get there. And then, you know, 50-50 chance we would get into some type of gunfight in Rara Kare. Then we would come back down to our fire base. We would take a day to do maintenance on our trucks, give the guys another day off. And inevitably, I would be sitting there at the end of another 2 weeks. I would walk down to Isak's hooch. I would open the door. I would flop down on that lumpy sofa. And Isak would go through his things, and he'd pull out a pack of smokes, pot of chai, and we would look at the calendar. I'd say, all right, Isak, that was a great operation in Rara Kare. You know, where do you think we should head next? And he would rub his chin. He would look at the map and point to the next village down, usually, and say, you know, Mr. Elliot, we could go to Mangrate. It's always very good hunting in Mangrate. And that was usually what we would do, and the war just kind of went on. Isak was a guy, as I mentioned, who'd been fighting there for 10 years. Most of the soldiers as his employ were members of his tribe, his very extended family. This gave him a very position of real importance in his community. You know, he was incentivized to be the commander of this unit. Everything he had came out of that. I would liken him more to a beat cop than to what we traditionally think of as a, you know, a General Eisenhower-esque figure with a grand strategy. And the conversation between us, as you know, was never like, Mr. Elliott, we can go, if we go to Arawakuray, then we go down to Mangrate, we can hit them in Malakshay, sealing the border, ending the war, I can go back to my crops, and maybe you can go get a Master of Fine Arts and write that novel of yours. I mean, that's just not the type of war that it was. So what type of war was it? And that's something I wanted to explore in story, and it's something that that I hope Green on Blue achieves. So with that in mind, I'd like to read you another passage that sort of gets at some of those themes. As Chris mentioned in the introduction, you know, this is the story of Aziz. And when we first meet him, he is living with his family. It's the time between the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan and the American invasion, so the 1990s when the Taliban was there. And in the opening pages, we see Aziz lose both of his parents in a raid on the village where he's from. And his brother, who is older, then takes him to a small city called Orgun, where they basically eke out a living as delivery boys in the marketplace until his brother is horrifically wounded in a bombing. And as his brother's in hospital, Aziz is recruited into the Special Lashkar, which is basically a militia unit working on the border. And the deal he's offered is that if he goes and enlists with this unit, this militia, his wages will serve to keep his brother in the hospital because he can't afford to. And so Aziz is sort of sucked into this cyclical cycle of war. As he's absorbed into that, he eventually is recruited to act as an informant in a village where this militia unit is trying to build an outpost. And so this passage is from the time when he's working as an informant. And as an informant, he is living with a fellow named Mumtaz. And Mumtaz is an old man who's sort of sworn off the war at this point in his life. But in his younger days, he was a Mujahideen fighter against the Soviets. And this is a little bit of Mumtaz's story. When my brother died, he said, it was not in the war we thought we fought. We were Mujahideen and treated as heroes in this village. Our battlefield achievements known by all, earning us honor, honor we became greedy for. This led to larger and more daring attacks. When the fighting slowed each winter, we'd grow impatient for it. The Russians stayed on their bases, and it was difficult to strike at them. An informant of ours in Orgun, a man who, like our father, ran a trucking company, told us how in a few nights a Russian convoy would pass our village along the North Road. Eager as we were, my brother and I asked few questions. The operation would be simple. After curfew, we'd bury a mine in the road, and in the morning, if the Russians didn't show up, we'd remove it. Some days later, in the darkness, my brother and I chipped a ditch out of the frozen earth and slid the mine in. We carefully repacked the crumbled soil and went home, giving the matter little thought, as if we'd planted a tree and casually wondered if it'd grow. We slept soundly, and early the following morning, before the sun rose, we returned to either inspect our kill or to recover the mine. As we walked through the clear, cold air, the snow on the distant hilltops glowed with firelight. The mine had struck, and we approached the road, riding on great gusts of enthusiasm. But still, our situation was uncertain. Who knew if the Russians had sent anyone to aid their convoy? Who knew if we'd come across any manic survivors? These were uncertainties we felt prepared for. We weren't prepared for what we found. As we crested a last ridge and glimpsed our kill, we saw only the beginning of our terrible mistake. Tilted against his side, as if the carcass of a great steel beast, was the truck. But it wasn't Russian. It was civilian and full of lumber that now burned in a pyre, sparkling on the snow. We kept our distance, but were close enough to feel the fire on our faces. We could see the cab in its white paint, which curled to scales against the heat, and then the steel beneath the paint that scorched to rust. Behind a shattered windshield, flames licked out an upright silhouette that burned with the dignity of one who met death immediately, without pain and shock. And through this absence, seemed strangely alive. I can't say how long we watched the pyre. When we left, the sun still hadn't risen, but the silhouette had been consumed. On our journey home, we said nothing and tried to hide in our silence. News of the attack spread through all the families of Gomal. The truck had been from our informant's company, and the dead driver had been his employee. Several days later, my father and our village Spengaris were called to a jirga in Orgun to settle the matter. The deliberations were short, lasting but 2 days, and my father returned in ruin. The Spengaris on both sides decreed that our father was responsible for our actions and that he must replace the destroyed truck and buy yet another to recoup the damaged cargo. In this, our informant made out very well, for the first truck forced us to sell our home, and the second wiped out my father's accounts, eliminating him as a business competitor. And that's when we moved here. You know, as we see in Mumtaz's story, he's basically, as a young man, as a mujahideen, you know, when he's thinking that he's fighting against the Russians, at a certain point he's basically duped into launching an attack for business purposes. And, you know, thematically in the book, something that, you know, I frequently address and something I frequently came across in Afghanistan is, again, these wars, especially as they go on for 30 years in the case of the Afghans, and now as Americans, you know, we look at our wars, which have been going on for 15 years. You know, wars have economies that build out of them. And I don't necessarily mean financial economies, although that can be part of it. But everything I've seen is that people behave according to their incentive structures. And after a while, the economies that build out around wars can be financial, they can be institutional, and they can be social. And so one byproduct of that is you wind up with wars that are oftentimes being fought for every reason but the ending of the war. And it's not necessarily because I think those actors are malice, you know, are behaving in malice. You know, it's often because they are behaving according to their incentive structures. So, for instance, my friend Isak, who I mentioned before, all of his status, all of his societal status, came from his position as commander of this militia unit. But then, if I'm going to want to be intellectually honest about this, I have to reflect on myself when I was a soldier. You know, for me, professional advancement, recognition, came from combat deployments. So for me, I was in many respects incentive to always be in Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, a deployment to Central Europe really didn't do me much in terms of my career aspirations. But those become very, very powerful forces, ones that I don't think we can place enough emphasis on. In writing the book too, just to change gears for a moment, I mentioned in my opening remarks that it's sort of any story, initially you're groping in the dark. And one thing Chris mentioned in her introduction is that the book is all told in the first person from the perspective of an Afghan, which is actually not how the novel started. When I worked in special operations, I also did work in the intelligence field. And the rhythm of my days was oftentimes punctuated with Afghans, or what we called walk-ins, coming onto whatever firebase you were at. And this, you know, for me, inevitably, I could set my watch by it. If I wanted to have an enormous pancake breakfast or get in a nice long hot shower, that was always when the Afghan would basically ring our doorbell and show up, and I would have to drop everything and go sit in a 3 or 4 hour debriefing with them. But there was a rhythm to those debriefings, and it would be me and an Afghan sitting across a desk from one another, and it was always him with a story, something that he thought was very, very important to convey, and my job to try to extract that story from him and determine its merits or its worth. In the early drafts of this novel, the rhythm of it was very much in that rhythm of a debriefing, where the character we hear, Aziz, who is telling his story, he actually, in the first writings of this book, he was telling it to an American character who never made it to the end of the novel. I pulled him out. The story sort of had a cadence that was a little bit, you know, like Conrad's The Heart of Darkness, in so much as in that book it opens with Marlowe telling his story of going up the river to go see Kurtz on a boat in the Thames to a small audience. And that was sort of the rhythm of the novel. And for 16 chapters, we heard Aziz's story. And at the beginning of every single one, it was to this one American. And probably about 9 months into the writing of this novel, a few drafts into it, I knew that that framework wasn't holding up, that this American character was too one-dimensional, and that to really blow him out, I was going to have to start telling a story that was really about an American. And my ambition had not been to tell an American story. It had been to try to harness the voices of many of these Afghans I'd sat with, some who were my friends, some who were my adversaries, and some who were my interlocutors. So I had to ask myself, why did I put this American there? You know, why am I afraid to let Aziz tell his story directly to the reader? being honest with myself, I sort of came to this realization that I had built out this American character as a crutch, and one that I needed early on in able to start trying to inhabit the mind of this Afghan, but one, at the end of the day, if I was being honest to the work, I knew I needed to remove and just sort of find the courage to let the novel succeed or fail on the merits of Aziz's voice alone. So I'd like to read one more passage from the novel, and this goes back to the beginning. And this is, as I mentioned, as the novel opens, Aziz and his brother Ali, their parents are killed in their village, and so they head to a city called Orgun to eke out a living. And this is Aziz's recollection of that time with his brother Ali. The next fall was our fourth away from home. This is when the Americans came. The militants in Orgun hid in the border mountains. At night they'd return. Some were Haqqanis, I think, but most now called themselves Taliban. A few were honorable men who practiced Pashtunwali, but many did as they pleased, taking what they wanted from homes and shops. We heard stories of far greater crimes outside Orgun. Militants accused men of being informants and beheaded them in front of their families. Americans accused men of being militants and disappeared them in the night on helicopters. The militants fought to protect us from the Americans, and the Americans fought to protect us from the militants. And, being so protected, life was very dangerous. Those who came to the market from smaller, far-off villages spoke of gun battles and bombings. We learned the names of commanders such as Sabir, Hafez, and later Ghazan. They fought on all sides and lived with us like shadows, like those of the boys we'd once slept beside in the mountains. The merchants in the bazaar picked no side. The politics of their war never changed. Survival. Ali and I continued to make deliveries. We also gave the merchants a watchful set of eyes at night. For this we were valued, and that seemed very good. One night, more than a year after Ali punched Rafi John, now one of our best customers, my brother said he had a gift for me. I asked him what it was, but he would tell me nothing. Instead, he turned down the flame of the oil lamp that sat between us on the floor. The room grew dark, and he held his index finger to the sky as he spoke. "Look there, Aziz. What do you see?" "Father's ring," I said. The ring shone in the dim lamplight, and I thought that perhaps he would give it to me. "Car, donkey," Ali snapped, and clapped me on the back of the head. "I point at the moon, and you stare at my finger. Do you see the moon? There." I looked past his finger and through a small shuttered window. "Yes," I said, "I see it. And what do you know of it?" "It is a half moon tonight." "Do you know why?" Ali asked. "No." "No," he repeated. "Do you feel any shame that you don't know?" "You don't know either," I reminded him. "You're right," he said. "I don't, but I feel shame because of it." And between us, it became quiet. "And this, father's ring," he said. "How would you replace it if it were lost?" "I would never lose it." "Someday it will be lost," he said. "And if we haven't learned to replace it, the loss will be complete." "If you give it to me," I said, "it will never be lost." I very much wanted the ring. Ali shook his head and spoke. "That is what those fools in the mountains say. Give it all to me and it will never be lost. They create nothing, and so the little over which they fight is already lost. You will learn another way. I have been saving our money so you might start at the madrasa." "Who will help you with work?" I asked, hurt by Ali's wish to be without me. "That is my burden now," he said. "Your burden is to be educated. It's what father wanted from me. It's what I can give you to make something new." "I won't abandon you," I said. "To not go, you abandon me." In these last words, he spoke the strongest of all. You know, as was noted, I think, you know, coming out of these wars, we've definitely seen, you know, a number of war fiction novels, short stories that are slowly emerging, you know, almost 10 years into this conflict. You know, and there's a long tradition of that. You know, after Vietnam, after the Second World War, you know, the First World War, which is really sort of, I think, the birth of modern war literature. You know, but it's interesting, I think, that as much as one is operating in this space, you know, and this might sound foolish, but I never set out necessarily to write a war novel. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the genre has always seemed very narrow, as though, you know, you're writing about battle scenes and gun sites and things of that nature. You know, for me, Green on Blue is really a story that's about, it's about brotherhood, it's about family, betrayal and loss and how people deal with grief. You know, the title of the novel, Green on Blue, refers to the ubiquitous insider attacks inside Afghanistan that many of you might have seen in the news, where an Afghan soldier who in military shorthand is considered green turns his weapon on his American advisor, who are in military shorthand called blue troops. And you have that type of attack. And in the book, it really acts as a metaphor. You know, what happens when the thing, when the cause that you believe in threatens to destroy you? You know, and that is very much Aziz's story. And it's not necessarily one that is about war. You know, it's about internally what's going on with Aziz, but much of it is fueled by war. So with that, I'd like to just read one last section. This is Aziz's description of the village he goes to work inside, called Gomal, and his impressions of the Afghans who live there. The night was cold, and all through it I got up, stepped lightly over Mumtaz, and fed dried branches into the mouth of the stove. Once the last scrap burned out in the fire, a chill set into my legs and woke me. I walked into the compound's dirt courtyard to wait for the dawn. As the early light came, I saw how poor Mumtaz was. His home was nothing more than the small coop, the mudroom we slept in, and the four walls of the courtyard. A ditch ran beneath one of the walls and out the back. Dishes were stacked alongside it. This was the kitchen. Past Mumtaz's compound were the mountains. Though it seemed these never ended, they were not enough to protect the village from the war, but they were enough to preserve it. It and its traditions. And even as isolated as the village was, sprouts of progress had arrived. Motorbikes, cell phones, and a few homemade satellite dishes that perched from rooftops, all standing as messengers from other, more modern worlds. But it was a false progress. It measured not movement forward, but the distance we would soon travel backward when the war destroyed everything. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'll take them.
Will I be able to pick up past pieces of the history and all that CNN and everything's covered, or do you think there'll be a prehistory that I'll need to be able to really get your message?
Sure. You know, in writing the novel, I did not set out to write a comprehensive history of Afghanistan down to the tribe and sub-tribe level. I mean, that would be a daunting task, and I think one that would get in the way of the book's ambition, which is to try to render some of the truths of that experience through story. And I think that's one of the things that fiction can do, that in, or at least a good story can do, in a way that, you know, these sort of thick policy tomes can't. And so for me, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning of the remarks, one of the ambitions of the novel was to, you know, I asked, you know, what type of war was it that we were fighting? And it was through a story to try to show this was the type of war. And it wasn't one that was aligned to what are at least traditional American conceptions of war with, you know, a beginning, a campaign, and then an end. So you won't need a primer on Afghanistan. It's a story. And if you can enjoy the story, you know, hopefully you'll take away some of those themes.
This is a really pedantic question, but why, was there any reason you used Orange Fanta in the... The kids are always drinking Orange Fanta.
That might be one of my all-time favorite questions that I've gotten. And the question was, how come they're drinking Orange Fanta in the novel? Because everywhere I've gone in the world, they drink Orange Fanta. I mean, anywhere, we don't seem to have it in the U.S., but everywhere else they seem to have Orange Fanta in the undeveloped world. And the character who's drinking the Orange Fanta Tawaz is kind of a little bit of a, so I call him like a kind of a rapscallion. And so it just sort of seemed like something that I know I loved when I was a kid. And he is, in some respects, sort of an overgrown kid. And so he loves drinking that Orange Fanta. But you know, thank you for picking up on that detail.
Thank you. You, as a writer, why did you enroll the military forces? And for Americans, what's the war like? You spoke about how Afghanistans see the war and what's the purpose of the war for them that has a social environment. But for for here, for your commanders, American commanders. What is the meaning of this war? Why people like you enrolled to the war?
You know, why did someone like me go into the military? Well, I was a Marine. I did ROTC in college, so I served as an officer when I graduated. I came into the military in 1998, so before 9/11. And I came in with a sense that I wanted, when I finished school, I wanted to have a job, or whether I was good at my job or bad at my job really mattered. You know, and it mattered in the Marines, and it mattered in terms of life's. And I could think of nowhere else where at 23 years old they would put me in charge of 45 people and give me a lot of responsibility. And I really liked that idea. I grew up overseas. That, I think, in some respects, you know, just gave me a vantage point on what it meant to be an American abroad. And I think that drew me to serve and to feel, you know, fortunate for some of the things we have as Americans. So I think that sort of combination, with the last ingredient being that I was like the kid who never stopped playing with his G.I. Joes, all sort of led me into the Marines. But in terms of, you know, what does the war mean for Americans? You know, I think it's an excellent question. I think it's one we should be asking, because the wars have been going on for 15 years. You know, the war in Afghanistan has been going on for 30 years. And what happens, you know, something that has fascinated me is this idea, you know, in the character Mumtaz, at one point when he's speaking to Aziz, he tells Aziz, looking back at his Mujahideen set days, he says, you know, Aziz, the future is in the remembering. You need to remember a time that's not like now. And so in a country like Afghanistan, it's been at war since 1979, well, the life expectancy in Afghanistan is high 50s, low 60s. So that means the people who were adults before the Russian, before the Soviet invasion, you know, who were 20 years old, they're getting well into their late 50s now. So if this war goes on for another 5, 10 years, pretty soon you won't have any Afghans alive who can really remember a time as adults when there was peace. So at that point, getting to pieces really becomes a pure act of imagination. You're creating it from whole cloth, and that's very, very dangerous. But then if we turn that lens on ourselves as Americans, we've been at war for 15 years, you know, and with talk of going back to Iraq to fight, with seeing as though there's going to be kind of no abatement in that regard, how does that reflect on us, and how do we get back to a place of peace? And I don't have the answers, but I feel like these are questions that are worth exploring, and I hope we do.
Did you get pushback from agents, editors, lay people, friends and family of, you know, why are you appropriating a different voice? Like, can you really do this? I mean, is that a criticism that you got or get? And if so, how do you respond to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be like sort of the criticism of cultural appropriation? Yeah, sure. You know, it depends on how you look at art. You know, what is art for? You know, I think art is something that we create to build bridges between people. And if we're only going to build small bridges that are close to our experience, you know, I think that puts a real limit on art. I felt very close to many of these Afghans. You know, they were my war buddies. We had an experience with one another that makes me, in many respects, closer to them than to many Americans. But at the same time, you know, I recognized that was probably going to be, that what might be a criticism that would be leveled at the work from a certain subset of people who might view art in that way. But, you know, I don't view it as that. I think in some ways you should be really trying to push the boundaries of what you're doing with your work and see how big you can make that bridge.
And my question is, as a writer, do you plan to write another book about war, or you plan to write something else? And you said that long wars, along with the long wars, the economy builds up as well. For you, apparently, you succeeded in writing such an interesting novel. But what is your next step? Is another war novel or something else?
Yeah, it's funny. I was actually just yesterday writing a piece that was sort of about this issue. And yeah, it's something I think about a lot, which is, you know, what is a war novel, what isn't a war novel, and where do you draw that line? You know, I think one of the greatest war novels of all time is The Great Gatsby. Nobody thinks of it as a war novel. But if you look at that novel, the First World War is all over that book. I mean, it's what takes Daisy Buchanan away from Gatsby. You know, Faulkner, in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, made this great statement where he says, you know, the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. And if you're going to look for those conflicts, I mean, so often you find them, whether or not the war is front and center, you know, in a book like Carlo Malante's Matterhorn, which is very much a in-the-trenches war novel, or if it's something that's sort of offstage propelling the narrative forward. you know, like in a Great Gatsby. So for me, it's difficult to say, you know, am I going to write about war next? Because it just always sort of seems to be there. Now, granted, I'm a veteran, so it definitely is something that gets projected onto me. But to give you a less ponderous answer, my next book is a love story that takes place on the Turkish-Syrian border. So I don't know if that's a war novel or not.
Is there really widespread heroin addiction in Afghanistan? And if so, who does it affect?
You know, my experience is there most certainly is. There is heroin addiction in Afghanistan. I think it is like heroin addiction in any other place, speaking specifically to the addiction. It's a, you know, it's a public health issue, and there are very high rates of it. There are also very high rates of it next door in Iran. You know, much has been made about the idea of needing to get the poppy crop out of Afghanistan, whether or not the war should just be about a more military-focused counterinsurgency, or whether or not we should be engaged in programs of widespread poppy eradication. And obviously, again, to this theme, the people behave according to their incentive structures. The idea is that you need to create an alternate set of incentive structures for people not to grow poppy, and that deals with how other crops are absorbed into the economy. So it's a huge issue in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is by far the majority producer of the world's heroin, but it's an issue that's is mired in levels of complexity linked to the war and linked into the economy. So it's something people are working through. But yeah, it's a problem.
Did you follow the path of your father? The one before you, you know, you just follow, do the same thing that they do.
No, you know, I, sure. So I think the question was about, you know, just kind of how I followed my professional path. Father was a businessman, and my mother was actually a novelist. So I grew up around books. I grew up with an appreciation of story and studied literature and history in college. Usually, the transition from, you know, active duty military and infantry and special operations, most guys aren't going on to write fiction. So sometimes it seems as though it's sort of a jarring professional switch.
Would you talk about that character of Mr. Jack?
Sure. So there's only one American in the book, a fellow named Mr. Jack. And Mr. Jack is a little bit of he's a somewhat shadowy character. He's sort of the fellow who finances the Special Lashkar, which is this militia unit. And in writing The American, I was in an interesting position, whereas, you know, some of the criticism that's been levied on writing that's come out of the wars from Iraq and Afghanistan, a criticism has been, you know, the Afghan and Iraqi experience has never really been factored into these stories. You know, they're always seen as these, you know, can be seen as these somewhat two-dimensional characters. We don't really see what's going on with them. And the war seems to just take place in a bubble of Americans who are over in these countries. And I understand that criticism, but, you know, I also understand that the American experience in Iraq and Afghanistan was largely divorced from the locals. But in writing the Mr. Jack character, I then had to say, okay, well, how does Aziz see this one American? And he actually sees him there's a lot of distance between the two of them. He's seen as somewhat two-dimensional. In many ways, Aziz sees Mr. Jack the same way Americans see the Afghans. And if I had tried to make a very three-dimensional rendering of this complex American character fueled in backstory and his failed marriages and his kids he never sees, Aziz isn't going to know any of that. He just sees him as one of these cycles of American advisors that come to the firebase and sort of keep things going. And that was the truth. And as much for me, I think there were Afghans I formed what I believe to be, you know, are real and true, honest relationships with. But, you know, when I was an advisor, I advised units that were as large as 700 Afghans, and I was one of a handful of Americans. And as much as there were a few Afghans I felt like were real friends, you know, the vast majority, they knew who I was because I was the American walking around, but to them I was a cardboard cutout. Sure.
That was my question too. How did you communicate?
So the question was, how do you communicate? I spoke passable Dari for a while. My Dari's pretty dusty right now, and I didn't speak Pashto. To give you guys an anecdote, so when I first showed up in Afghanistan and had been working on my Dari, the first Afghan I worked with was a man named Colonel Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, No joke. And so when I first met Colonel Jabbar, I had been rehearsing, you know, how I would introduce myself. So I would introduce myself, Isme man toran kahraman azdin shema khosh khodam, which means my name is Captain Ackerman. Seeing you brings me much joy, which is sort of the formal greeting. So I'd rehearsed it, and I sit there, and I meet him. And I say, you know, Colonel Jabbar, Isme man toran kahraman azdin shema khosh khodam. He says, toran kahraman? I say, toran Ackerman? Yeah, toran Ackerman. Ackerman? It's like, toran kahraman. Kahraman. Yeah, Kahraman, yeah, that's close enough. He's like, Kahraman, BCR Hubas, which means this is the best. And I sort of say, what's going on? He says, this guy, my one interpreter says, Kahraman means brave guy. It's like, you are Captain Brave Guy, you are Captain Hero. So like, that's right, I am Toran Kahraman. So for the next 8 months, I got to be Captain Hero. And yeah, it's just a funny anecdote. But we, you know, Pigeon Dari, I would speak with him. A few of them spoke English pretty well. You know, one of the challenges, again, in writing the book, though, was, you know, I was sitting with a friend of mine who's a novelist when the book was still in drafts, and we were talking about it. And he asked, sort of, he said, how are you handling the language? And I sort of was explaining it to him. So I told him the first person. He looked at me and said, you know, you've written a novel in Pashto. And I sort of thought about that for a second. I was like, oh my God, I guess you're right. It is in Pashto. And so much as when you're hearing Aziz speak, he's speaking Pashto. Everyone is speaking Pashto in the book. When this one American character, Mr. Jack, walks on, he is American who they describe. He speaks Pashto. But when the Afghans, when Aziz is describing his manner of speaking, he says, you know, Mr. Jack spoke Pashto like a child. And when you hear and read the dialogue in the book, you'll see it's choppy. It's not particularly eloquent because that's how the Afghans are hearing him speak Pashto. But it was something that was, you know, always on my mind in the book and in the cadence of the dialogue.
I was just wondering, because I'm hearing your stories about your experience, and I'm wondering, are you going to be, or have you been sort of communicating those in some way, or putting them together in some sort of essay or something? Because they're horribly interesting, you know, some sort of memoirs or something. Have you thought about that?
Sure. So I think the question was, do I also write kind of things that are more close to my experience and in essay? Yeah, I do. I write... I also write in, you know, essays very frequently. I live in Istanbul and spend a lot of time on the Turkish-Syrian border, where I've been researching a novel. But, you know, for me, a lot of my process and my research, I would say, I mean, everyone has a different method. I would say mine is a little bit immersive, where I will sort of see something that is going on that interests me, and I will kind of just plop myself in the middle of it. I first started going down to the Turkish-Syrian border because a couple of friends of mine started a research organization that was basically bidding on government contracts and contracts from humanitarian aid organizations down there. And they basically invited me to come along, you know, be the guy who would wash the car, make the coffee, sort of do odd jobs. And I just set up down there. As I was down there, too, I've been writing, you know, a lot of nonfiction, you know, essays, you know, narrative nonfiction. And it's been informing, you know, what is my next novel. So I do write. You know, and I, frankly, too, have always felt a little bit uncomfortable. I think particularly, you know, as Americans, we draw very, very clear and strong lines between fiction, nonfiction, what one is, you know, what either is. It's not the first time this has been said, but a poet friend of mine said, you know, one of the things I love about poetry is it's the only medium where there's no distinction between fiction and nonfiction. I've always felt very uncomfortable by those distinctions, too.
Have your friends in Afghanistan read your book, and what do they say about it?
The novel is dedicated to Ali and Big Cheese, who were my friends, who were two Afghans I worked with. They were two soldiers who started as soldiers, then eventually became interpreters, and you know we spent a lot of time with one another. They both had aspirations to come to the U.S., and for reasons I won't get into, unfortunately, those aspirations went unfulfilled. They have not read the book. I mean, their English is such where I don't think they would be able to, and they're still in a very remote part of Afghanistan fighting. That being said, I have friends in Afghanistan who read the book to sort of check particularly the slang that's in it. There's a lot of Pashto slang in the book, so, you know, they've looked through it as well. But, you know, I would hope that, you know, it would find an interest among Afghan readers, and I would hope that they would think it, and again, so much of the novel's ambition from the outset was just to try to render this world and render the war, you know, as they saw it, the best that I could.
As you mentioned, writing as an art, and usually as an artist, you, or I would imagine that you would work on something and develop it to a point where you feel that it's ready and that you can let it go. On the other hand, you mentioned your military service, how you noted that the general that you were speaking with or meeting with wouldn't make decisions that would change a lot, that he kind of used the war in a certain way. How did you come out of your military experience feeling like you had achieved something that you could let it go, kind of rendering something in art that you could produce and let go, and something in your career and in your life that you could produce and let go? Did you feel frustrated that, or that
sure,
you
I mean,
like
so sort of how did I have the distance to take something that had been very close to me and try to render it in art? Is that the question? Sort of. Yeah, you know, I think that's very, I knew for years that I would write about the war. Like, I knew I wanted to. I knew that whenever it was over for me, and in those years, I didn't know when it was going to be over for me. And I think one of the things that's interesting about these wars, because they haven't ended the way even wars like Vietnam ended. I mean, they're still going on. Everyone who's been involved in them has had to make a separate piece, sort of had to say, like, okay, I'm good, I'm done. And for me, that was after 8 years. Interestingly enough, I knew I would write about the wars. I was in Afghanistan, and I had made the decision that this was going to be my last deployment. I basically tendered my resignation over email, kind of told the people I was working with that when I came home, you know, I was going to be moving on. And within, no hyperbole, about 2 days, I started writing, you know, it would be one of the, it's actually not in this book, but it was one of the first scenes I ever kind of wrote out. And it was just the act. I didn't know what it would be, but the act of knowing it was over for me was what sort of, that mental shift was what allowed me to kind of start that process. So, you know, I think it's something that's very real. I mean, some people, writers I know who've been in the wars, you know, were writing while they were in the wars. For whatever reason, I couldn't do it. I was too close to what was going on then. Thank you. Thank you so much.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.